Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Joseph Brinton, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and by Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute also offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., the nation's only campaign management minor, and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Cartooning in Utah, and today's guest is Pat Bagley. In 1977, during a finance class at BYU, Bagley doodled a political cartoon which he submitted to the student newspaper, The Daily Universe. This became his first published cartoon, which was reprinted in the Time magazine just weeks later. After graduation, Bagley briefly worked as a caricaturist in the nearby Orem Mall before being hired as the editorial cartoonist at the Salt Lake Tribune, where he still produces a daily cartoon. His cartoons have appeared in the Washington Post, the Guardian of London, the Times of London, the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, and the Los Angeles Times. Over the years, he's produced more than 10,000 cartoons for the Tribune. Bagley is syndicated, and his work is regularly featured at Daryl Cagle's Political Cartoonist Index. In 1992, Bagley received the Wilbur Award for Religious Communication from the Religious Public Relations Council for a cartoon in April of 23rd of 1991. He was the first cartoonist to receive the award, which is given for outstanding communication of religious values in the news and entertainment media. Bagley was the recipient of the 2007 Torch of Freedom Award from the American Civil Liberties Union of Utah. Bagley was also awarded the 2009 Herbluck Prize for Editorial Cartooning by a unanimous panel of judges. So please join with me in welcoming our guest, Pat Bagley.
Thank you. Great introduction. Thought I'd expand a little bit on where I got started on doing this. I'm a BYU alumni, but I still root for the Utes, mostly because my father went to school here a long time ago. And J.D. Williams, who's pictured right there, was his first political science instructor. And my father was one of his first students. So, you know, I've got this connection that goes way back to the University of Utah. I was at BYU. I was taking political science, and there was an issue that came up. The Justice Department was suing BYU because BYU didn't allow men and women to live in the same apartment building. And that was a violation of civil rights, and so the Justice Department was going to bring a suit against BYU. And I was in this class that was called Personal Finance, and the class was just deadly dull. But it's one of those things that's good for you. You know, it tells you about long-term insurance and short-term insurance and all this other stuff you're supposed to know. But my mind would drift. And when that would happen, I would start to doodle in my class notes. And I'm sure that you guys never do that. You're always just right on, right? So I started to doodle in my class notes as I usually did. And then, right in the middle of the class notes, this cartoon, fully formed, just kind of comes out of me. And the cartoon has to do with this issue of the Justice Department suing BYU. And, you know, I look at it and I think it's not a bad cartoon. What I'll do is I'll go to the Daily Universe, the school newspaper, and I'll give it to them, and they'll have their cartoonist, Steve Benson, do a final copy and they can run it. And so I went up to the Daily Universe and I showed them the cartoon, and the editor looked at it, and he goes, well, this goes along with the story that we're doing. And he says, can you do a finished copy of this? So I ran home, and I did a final copy, and I gave it to him, and they ran it the next day in the newspaper. And that experience of seeing your stuff in print is pretty heady stuff. It was like heroin to me, you know. Once I got hit by that, I wanted to do cartoons. I just knew that's where I wanted to be. And so they had me start doing cartoons, and then their cartoonist left during the summer, and they asked if I would stick around during the summer and do more cartoons, so I did more cartoons. And I really like this, right? and I'm getting pretty close to graduation, and my mother is saying, you know, what are you going to do? You know, you got to make a decision here. And I said, well, I'm going to follow up on this cartooning thing. And she laughed at me. And I'll never forget what she said. She said, the only kind of artist is a starving artist. And she wanted me to go on to get a degree in public administration or maybe go on to law school, which is kind of what political science prepares you for, I guess. But at the time, I was also working at a graphics place on campus. And so it's about a month after my cartoon came out in the newspaper, I go into work, and the secretary says, congratulations on getting your cartoon in Time Magazine. And this is the first I'd heard of it. So I said, well, are you sure? And she goes, well, I'm pretty sure it was your cartoon. And she described the cartoon, and sure enough, it was the cartoon. So I ran out, and I got a copy of Time Magazine, and sure enough, it was in that issue of Time Magazine. So the very first cartoon that I ever did got published in Time Magazine. And it's been downhill pretty much since then. Now, like I say, I was taking political science at BYU, and it was because I was brought up in a fairly political household. I told you that my father went to school here, and he eventually got a degree in public administration. But he had a hard time finding a job in Utah. This is something that isn't generally well known, but Utah really didn't get out of the Great Depression until the 1970s. For all that time, the economy was fairly depressed and unemployment was fairly high in Utah. So he had a hard time finding a job, and he did all kinds of stuff. But eventually he got this job in Oceanside, California, where he was a draftsman in the planning department. And so, you know, Oceanside, California sounded pretty good. And back in the mid-50s, it must have been just heaven. So we all moved down there, and that's where I grew up. And Dad continued with the city of Oceanside. He got recognized because he was a fairly bright guy. So he goes from being a draftsman in the planning department to being the assistant to the planning director, and then he became the planning director, and then from there he became city manager. This is over the course of, you know, a few decades. And if you know anything about city government, it's pretty cutthroat. Another thing that my dad said that I'll never forget was that no politics is as dirty as local politics. And city managers have got a lifespan of about 5 to 7 years if they're good. So after, about 10 years, the city council decides that they want to get rid of my father for political reasons. And so they fire him. And what he does is he decides he's going to run for mayor. And so he throws his hat into the ring and he runs for mayor and he wins. But to make the victory even sweeter is all the people who fired him lost. So he became the mayor of Oceanside, California, and he was mayor for 3 terms. And I'm giving you this history just because this is the kind of household that I grew up in, where politics was kind of our mother's milk. So each night we'd have the TV on listening to one of the 3 network news programs. In the mornings we'd have the newspaper all laid out. We talked about politics a lot. I always remember seeing my father read. He was a voracious reader. He likes to tell the story of, he got a book by Richard Nixon. It was called 5 Crises, I think. And this is back before Nixon was president. And he had been vice president. And he wrote this book. And it was supposed to be one of the ways he was going to run for president, was on this book. And so my father got this book, 5 Crises, and he actually had Richard Nixon sign it. And so he had the signed copy of Richard Nixon's book. But then after Nixon ran for president against JFK in 1960, Nixon lost, And he also came out with that thing where he said, you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. And he just kind of dropped from public sight. So Dad was going through his books, and he decided this book wasn't worth anything. And so he gave it to the library, you know. And I wish I had that book today. You know, a signed copy of this book by Richard Nixon. So I grew up in this household that was very political. When I went to BYU, you know, I wanted to be an artist. I had aspirations that way, but again, my mother was not really supportive of that. So I went into political science, you know, because of the household I grew up in, and it was something that I understood. And also, it kind of animated me. And at that time, I started to read books and going to classes, and all of a sudden it dawned on me that this stuff does matter. And so I started to develop my political philosophy. And I read Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, and I read Jack Kemp's book on politics. And I bring this up because when Paul Ryan, who's now the Republican vice president's nominee, was selected, I did a little research on him, and I found out that his book list, you know, absolutely matched my book list when I was in college. Ayn Rand, the whole bit. And so I was coming out of college, I was probably libertarian, you know, fairly conservative. Now, a friend of mine who grew up with me in Oceanside, California, also went to BYU. And as kids, we used to have these debates. I was conservative, and he was a socialist, you know, and we'd have these debates as 15-year-old kids, as only 15-year-old kids can. And we kept in contact through college. And like I say, he was fairly liberal, and he was an out-and-out socialist. And he remembers that we met in the library one afternoon, and I told him about this book, The Road to Serfdom by Friedrich Hayek. And I said, you got to read this stuff. And so I lost contact with Val for, I don't know, 30 years almost. And then along comes Facebook, and all of a sudden you can pick up on all these relationships that you had decades before. And I find out that Val Lamson is now teaching economics down at BYU. And I think, well, that's a curious thing for a socialist to be doing. And so I contact him, and we got together for lunch, and we decided that we just did this complete 180, where he had gone from being a socialist to now he's very much a libertarian, very conservative. And I went from being very conservative to, well, becoming fairly left of center. How many of you have seen my cartoons, are familiar with them? Okay. Would you accept that description as being left of center? Okay, yeah. And my journey from being libertarian, conservative, to where I am now, I have to thank George W. Bush for it. George W. Bush was elected in 2000, and he was the ideal conservative candidate, the candidate of small government, tax cuts, and no to little regulation. And so for 8 years, George Bush and the Republicans had their way of tax cuts and cutting back on regulation. And in my mind, it resulted in an ultimate disaster, you know, the 2008 financial collapse. The Republicans still like to say that that was caused by too much regulation. But to me, watching this thing from the very beginning, and seeing it happen, and it's like watching a disaster unfold. You know, I knew it was going to happen. To my mind, it all happened because of there was no regulation. In fact, the regulators were in bed with the banks. And so that kind of flipped me, you know, where you had kind of the conservative dream of running a country, and then they did it and it didn't work out. And I think that we've gone too far in that direction. You know, this all started happening during Ronald Reagan, and this whole tax cut thing has played itself out. And you know, they still like to say that, you know, tax cuts stimulate the economy. And they say things like, you know, you should let people keep their money because they do better things with it than you would, than the government would. Well, the problem with that is, why not let them keep all their money then? You know, in that case, then we wouldn't have roads, we wouldn't have schools, we wouldn't have bridges. But Republicans have just gone on this tax tear for the past three decades, and it's kind of gone out of balance. And so even though people call me up all the time and say I'm a socialist and I'm a Marxist, I'm really not. I'm just in favor of some balance. And if you want to have a civil society, you've got to be able to, well, you've got to have taxes. You should pay your taxes. Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was the great Supreme Court justice, said, "I like paying taxes because with it I buy civilization." So, in a way, that's how I ended up doing the cartoons, the kind of cartoons that I'm doing right now in the Salt Lake Tribune. And when I won the Herblock Award, the guy called up, and he's asking me questions, and the thing that is really he wants to get at, finally, is he just kind of blurts it out. He says, "What are you doing in Utah?" And so I explained to him that the Salt Lake Tribune has always been kind of a counterweight to the LDS Church in Utah and has always been kind of, you know, fairly left-of-center liberal. And so, you know, we have our place here. I had a pretty good spot in the Salt Lake Tribune. You know, I've been there for almost 35 years now. When I started doing cartoons back in 1979, there must have been 300 cartoonists in the country. There were 300 newspapers that could afford their own cartoonist, and there were lots of us. And now I'm one of maybe 45 cartoonists that still work for a newspaper. And it's because of the collapse of newspapers. I get calls from people who say that the reason that newspapers are having a hard time is because they're liberal and they're part of the mainstream media. And then that's become kind of a dirty word. But the real reason that newspapers have had such a hard time is because of Craigslist and KSL.com. When I started at the newspaper, we used to have sections of classifieds. You know, we'd have three different sections, you know, which is, you know, the whole part of the paper. You know, maybe 20, 25 pages of nothing but classifieds. And it was a real revenue stream, and papers were making money hand over fist. Now, we are lucky to have two or three pages of classifieds. And so that's the reason that newspapers are having such a hard time these days. Well, I've given you, you know, kind of my history and how I ended up doing what I'm doing here in Utah. So I thought I'd open it up to questions, and we'll just take it from there.
If you have a question, please speak directly into the microphone, state your name, and a little bit about yourself.
Hey, my name is Mary. My question is, what's the most controversial cartoon you've ever drawn, and kind of what was the reaction?
The one that got the most response was something I did when I started at the paper. I'd been there for about 5 years, and there was this news item that came up that public employees were going to be given another holiday. And so the cartoon that I drew shows this public employee, state employee, he's in a cubicle, and you see the calendar on the wall, and there's a holiday, and then there's a, you know, free work day, and then there's a vacation day, and so he's on the phone, and he says, another holiday? I don't know if I can work it into my busy schedule, you know, because the calendar's all filled up with all these holidays and days off and stuff like that. So it was, you know, kind of slamming public employees. And so the next day I get into work, and at 8 o'clock in the morning, the phones light up. And we have six lines coming into the Tribune. And pretty soon they all light up. And the whole newsroom is fielding calls for me. And I'm on the line as well, you know, talking to these people, trying to calm them down. And they're all just outraged that I have slammed, you know, state employees. They all tell me they work hard. And so I decided I'm going to have a little fun with them. You know, after you talk to the same person with the same argument. So I would ask him, well, you know, you guys in that arm of government work really hard, but what about those guys in transportation? Oh, yeah, those guys are so lazy. So anyway, The calls went from 8 o'clock in the morning until 12 o'clock. And then they stopped for about an hour. Then they picked up at 1 o'clock. And they went until 5 o'clock. Absolutely true. And I found out later that they had sent out a mimeographed copy of Talking Points, you know, with my number on it and, you know, talking about the cartoon and what they should tell me. And so they'd spread this all over, you know, and that's, I personally feel that probably 100 calls, and there had to have been, you know, over 1,000 calls that day about that cartoon. That's the cartoon that's got the most response. I think the cartoon that had the biggest effect was when the Tribune had just been bought by a new owner, and up until that point, the Tribune did not endorse candidates. Last time we'd endorsed a candidate was Richard Nixon, you know, and that didn't turn out very well. So for decades, we didn't endorse candidates. But this new owner decided that he was going to do endorsements, and this is 2004, and he wants to endorse George Bush. And I don't want to endorse George Bush. And it's not really clear in this new relationship I have with the newspaper, with this new publisher, what he expects me to do. Does he expect me to follow the party line and do what he wants me to do? Whereas I see my cartoons as being more of a columnist, you know, where I sign my name to it, and it's my opinion. But I was having a hard time figuring out what to do, and then it hit me. Well, I'll do this cartoon. So the cartoon that came out in the paper said, "The choice is simple," with a picture of George Bush looking kind of dim. You know, you got to think about it for a minute. The choice is simple. Okay. But I'm proud of that one, and it got a lot of response, and it helped the Tribune, because we had, you know, I was telling you about all those calls that we had when I had that one cartoon. Well, it was worse when we endorsed George Bush. Our publisher was surprised because he thought that Utah was a very conservative state, and he didn't understand that the Salt Lake Tribune is not necessarily a Mormon newspaper. And he was very surprised that in the state that's solidly red, that that his endorsement of George Bush didn't go over very well. Now, just a week ago, the Salt Lake Tribune came out with an endorsement again. And this time, who did we endorse? Obama. And there's a big backstory behind that. You know, originally we're going to endorse Romney, which makes sense because he was the guy who saved the Olympics, and he's our favorite son. And, you know, the only question in Utah is he going to get 78 or 80% of the vote in Utah? So it was a smart thing to do, would have been the smart thing to do to endorse Romney. It was a logical thing to do. But the thing that turned it around was that tape that came out of Romney talking about the 47%. And that didn't sit well with my publisher. And so that's what kind of flipped him. Question?
So I have a question, if I may. So have you ever written a cartoon in which you decide to scrap it after you've written it because you think it might be too controversial? Or you just say, like, you don't feel like you can publish something like that?
Lots of different answers to that. I have done cartoons where I've put it in the paper and I'm going down the elevator to go home, and then something hits me that I go, oh no, I should have done this. And I go back and I do a whole different cartoon because it's better. There have been other instances where I've done a cartoon, and between the time that I did the cartoon, events transpire that give a completely different meaning to that cartoon, one that I didn't intend. This happened with something that was going on in the Granite School District a long time ago, and it's too convoluted to get into, and it's boring too. So I'll tell a story about Robert Kirby, who's our columnist. Same thing happens to him, where on September 10th, 2001, he wrote this article about learning how to fly, about taking flight training. And he jokes about, you know, if it was him flying, he'd probably fly it into a building. And then the next morning, September 11th, you know, and then you get, and you know, he didn't know, he couldn't possibly have known. But all of a sudden, the article takes on a whole different meaning. And so I've had a couple cartoons where that's happened. And sometimes I like to do cartoons just to give my editor a heartburn, you know. And he doesn't care mostly what I do, but he wants to see cartoons that have to do with the LDS Church and, you know, if they have to do with something radical like, well, abortion is a pretty hot-button issue. He wants to see those before I go ahead and do them. And so just for fun, I'll do a cartoon that I'll know, I just know, you know, can't possibly go in the paper because it's just too radioactive. And it's just kind of fun to watch him go, well, I don't know, you know, and I said, no, it's fine, I won't do it. And then I do something that's really bad, but not as bad as that one, and he's just happy I didn't do the really bad one.
My name's Kyle Perkins, and I've seen and looked at a lot of your cartoons, and I'm just curious, how much do you perceive your cartoons swaying the political opinions of people who read them? Because they've made me think a lot about different issues and candidates.
Well, when I do a cartoon, a cartoon can accomplish one of three things or all three things. It can entertain you, you know, it can make you laugh. It can inform you. You know, there are certain issues that you have heard about, but you don't know that much about. But a cartoon can really inform you. And the last thing that a cartoon should do is persuade you. So the question is, how persuasive can they be? And I'm really happy to hear that that they make you think, which is what they're supposed to do. As far as persuading people, you know, I do hope that it makes people stop and think and kind of look at the other side of things and weigh things. But today, people are so polarized and they're already so set in their ways of thinking that I'm not really sure how much my cartoons persuade people. I know that people who are inclined to like my cartoons and kind of like my politics, it will just bolster their established ideas. And other people who watch Fox News and listen to Hannity, it's not going to influence them at all. I'm pretty sure of that. But if it makes you think, then I'm more than happy to hear that.
My name's William Perkins. I'm a political science student here at the U. I was just wondering, you kind of already answered this. Do you get pushed or pulled in either direction on what kind of cartoon you are going to put in? And also, do you get much backlash from people on the Capitol or in the legislature from the cartoons that you put out?
So two questions is, when I started at the Tribune, it was a big question about what my relationship to the paper was, because they had never had a cartoonist before. And it's always the editor's inclination to think that you are their guy and that you should be supporting the editorial policy of the Salt Lake Tribune. And my inclination was to do what I wanted to do and, you know, to follow my own political inclinations. And early on in the Tribune, you know, there was this kind of back and forth. And eventually I kind of established myself, and I established my own voice. And also they got really tired of trying to work with me. And so they just kind of threw up their hands and gave up. And, you know, they still have editorial control, and they still can pull a cartoon and kill a cartoon. And that happens maybe a couple times a year is all. But I'm pretty lucky to be where I am doing it for the Tribune. The old cartoonist for the Deseret News wasn't so lucky. He used to, and he was great. The guy was a genius. But he was required to do a rough draft of the cartoon, and then he had to take it to his editor on the editorial page, and then they would take it to the editor of the paper, and then if there was still some question about it, they'd take it to the publisher. And if after that, you know, there was still some question about the cartoon, they'd kick it across the street to the church office building, you know, to see if they were okay with it. And all along the way, each of these people had to initial that cartoon. And in the meantime, you know, Cal is sitting on his thumbs waiting for these people to do this. And it just got to be ridiculous. And he did this one cartoon about Marcos in the Philippines, you know, who was not a good guy and oppressed his people. And so he did a cartoon like every other cartoonist in America, critical of Marcos. And, you know, there was nothing all that outrageous about this cartoon. But he got word down through the pipeline that he wasn't going to do any more Marcos cartoons because it might hurt the missionary effort in the Philippines. And so, like I say, I'm glad that I don't work for the Deseret News because they have a whole different set of priorities from the Salt Lake Tribune. They do each talk to different audiences. The Deseret News, I've got to say, they do have some great writers, and they've done some great features, and they do some great things. But then you got to go back and kind of look at what ultimately, who they're serving and what their goal is. The Salt Lake Tribune, we are, well, we're independent, you know. There was another part of that question. What was it? Oh, yeah. When I started doing cartoons about them up there, it was something new to them, and they weren't quite ready for it. And I did this cartoon suggesting that in the caucuses where they can go behind the closed doors and they can do all this stuff in secret, that actually they were partying with lots of girls and they were drinking and stuff like that. And, you know, of course it's a cartoon, and of course it's, you know, ridiculous, but they took it very seriously, you know. And so they were calling and writing letters. We don't party behind closed doors. We don't have girls. We don't drink. Well, of course you don't, you know. But over time, they've learned to not respond quite so foolishly, I guess. And if you are familiar with my cartoons, there's that character that I do, who is the Utah legislator, you know, the kind of pudgy guy with the thick lips. He's a shorthand way that I can show this person. It used to be that I had to write the legislature, you know, on somebody, and it didn't really work out all that well because, you know, that's a lot of writing. But now I have this legislator character, and you know exactly who I'm talking about when you see him. One of my favorite legislator cartoons was you see a couple legislators walking down the steps of the state capitol, and one is saying, "Remember when the word gay meant happy, fun-loving, lighthearted?" The next frame is, "You know, I hated it back then, too."
All right, questions.
Hey, Pat. I'm Enrique. I'm a health promotion education major here at the U. Have you heard anything from the church when you do your cartoons, or do they keep pretty quiet?
Okay, you know about the controversy of doing cartoons of the prophet, and how that just riles up the Middle East, and the place just blows up if some cartoonist in Denmark does a cartoon about the Prophet Muhammad. Well, decades before that, I had to wrestle with, what do I do when there's a prophet of the LDS Church who is in the news? You know, can I do a caricature of this guy? Because as far as I knew, a sitting president of the LDS Church had never been caricatured and, you know, put in paper. And so that was the line that I had to figure out where I was going to go. And it was because Gordon B. Hinckley had become president of the LDS Church, and he was very different from all the other LDS presidents who were very standoffish and did not give access to the press. They never gave interviews to the press. And all of a sudden we have Gordon B. Hinckley, who's very accessible to the press. And he's going out there, he's on 60 Minutes, and he actually becomes good buddies with Mike Wallace. He goes on Larry King and talks to Larry King, and you know, he's talking to the newspapers, and he's out there in the public. And so I'm deciding, well, you know what? If he's in the public eye, then he's fair game. And so I did this cartoon that shows him with Larry King, and Larry King is saying, "And when we come back, more of Mormons, ordinary people just trying to become gods." And there's Gordon B. Hinckley in this cartoon, and it ran, and I got calls from all sorts of people who are more than willing to be offended on behalf of, you know, Gordon B. Hinckley. But then I found out through back channels that Gordon B. Hinckley had seen the cartoon, and he kind of liked it. You know, he does look kind of cute in this cartoon. And another curious thing about the interview with Larry King is Larry King seemed to be fascinated by the whole idea of polygamy, you know, Mormons and polygamy. And he was talking about, you know, when did Brigham Young, how many wives did Brigham Young have? When did it start? You know, did it ever really end? You know, and he just was obsessed with polygamy. Well, the funny thing is that Larry King was married 7 times. So he had a vested interest in the whole subject, I guess.
Any questions?
Pat, go back to the Utah State Legislature. Have you ever had occasion where a legislator has contacted you directly? Maybe you've sat down with a legislator with regard to your free speech rights and how you have produced a product that entertains, informs, but also maybe persuades on certain legislation?
On a couple of occasions, I've been contacted directly by representatives. And I've got to hand it to them because they were trying to persuade me on a certain topic. Actually, they were trying to educate me on some things. And, you know, I listened to them, and it did lead me to research the subject a little bit more. It didn't necessarily change my view, but I was better informed, you know, later when I was doing cartoons about it or talking about it. There have been a few cartoons that I've done where I think that it has changed things. It doesn't happen very often. When I do a cartoon about national politics, it is like, you know, it's just another minnow nibbling away at Obama or Romney. You know, it's just another pebble in the landslide. It just kind of goes unnoticed. But if I do a cartoon about a local issue, it's like a shark attack. You know, if I did a cartoon, for instance, about Mayor Rocky Anderson, he was going to hear about that all day long. So if I do cartoons about local politics, it tends to have a greater impact. And yes, on the state level, I think that embarrassing them helps, you know, and stops them from doing really foolish things. I can't necessarily say it was my cartoon that did it, but it was a year or two ago when the legislature tried to make access to public records difficult. They wanted to shut off our access to public records. And I came out with cartoons, and the Salt Lake Tribune also came out with a front-page editorial, which we'd never done before. But we put a lot of pressure on the governor and the legislators to you know, roll that back, because what they did was just going way too far. And it actually worked. You know, they kind of scuttled back to their rock.
I'd just like to get your thoughts on the whole the Mia Love and Jim Matheson battle going on there, and the redistricting that Jim Matheson's had to put up with.
This is it's interesting because, you know, Mia Love kind of came out of nowhere. You know, because we do have an extra seat, and the legislature got to redraw the boundaries, and they were faced with a question: do we create a reservation for Democrats in the middle of the state and have 3 Republican seats, or do we try to get it all? Do we try to get all of these new congressmen to be Republicans? And so the legislature, which gets to draw the boundaries, they decided they were going to go for it all. They're going to, instead of letting the Democrats have 1 House seat, they were going to draw the lines so that it favored Republicans. And Jim Matheson had to decide what he was going to do. You don't, in Utah, you don't have to live in the boundaries of your House seat to run for that House seat. And so Matheson could choose. And he could stay in a second district, which, you know, looked fairly Republican, or he could go for the new fourth district. And he was counting on running against this guy named Wimmer, who was up in the legislature. And Wimmer would have been easy pickings. And so he decided to run in the fourth House seat. And then when the GOP convention comes around, where they decide who's going to be their nominee, Mia Love comes out of nowhere. And she's dynamic and charismatic and holds herself, you know, very well, and she just blows everybody away. And that is what Matheson was not counting on. He didn't expect that. And on the other hand, if he had stayed in the second district, there was enough funny business going on in that nomination that a lot of Republicans are very upset at the current nominee, which is Stewart. They don't feel kindly towards their own nominee, and Matheson would have had an easier time. Mia Love is kind of a phenomena. You know, she is very much a Tea Party politician, and she kind of hews to the Tea Party line. And to my mind, she's kind of inexperienced, and that Tea Party line is pretty radical stuff, if you look at it. But Matheson has his work cut out for himself. And to do it, he is positioning himself as a moderate Republican. You know, he really doesn't represent Democrats in the state. Does that answer your question?
Hi, I'm Dylan Leard, and I was just wondering if you've ever, maybe not taken a bribe, but ever had a call from, like, Peter Cook or something to maybe not make him look so bad in a newspaper so he might not look as bad for an election or anything such as that.
That's like throwing gasoline on the flames. I mean, if somebody calls me up and wants me not to do them, I'm going to find out some reason to go ahead and do them. So, no, I haven't been approached that way. But I have done cartoons about Orrin Hatch over the years. And, you know, I thought, man, this is really going to get him. This is going to sting. And then I'll get a call from him the next day, saying, "Oh, I, you know, appreciated that, and I appreciate what you do, and, you know, can I have a copy of that cartoon? Can I have the original?" And it really kind of takes the wind out of my sails. So that's a good thing to remember: is if you show up angry, it's not going to help. But you know, showing that you have a sense of humor and that you appreciate things like that, you kind of go, "Oh, well, he's not a bad guy."
Jim Matheson, two cartoons. One I'm holding here. Sure looks like Chris Van Oker.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome to our live debate between Democratic Congressman Jim Matheson and his Tea Party challenger, Mia Love. And suddenly, Chris Van Oker's interrupted. "I promise to fight the tyranny of Obama's socialist agenda." In the last second frame, Chris Van Oker says, "Please wait for the question, Congressman." That one, and also another one where Jim Matheson is in a hot tub along with an elephant. Mm-hmm. And he indicates that he has many principled reasons for being in a hot tub with an elephant. Just wondering if you could comment on those two cartoons.
Yeah. I listened to the debate between Matheson and Mia Love, and it just astounded me how hard Matheson was trying to distance himself from Obama. You know, it was almost ridiculous. It was like, you know, I don't even know the guy. I don't know Obama. You know, and this guy's supposed to be a Democrat. But in Utah, that's what you got to do, is run away from Obama, because we are such a Republican state. I mean, Scott Matheson was Jim Matheson's father. And I'm old enough to remember Scott Matheson. And Scott Matheson was a great governor. He kept the legislature in check, didn't let them run off and spend this money on foolish lawsuits. And he worked with Republicans, and they worked together very well. But now we've lost balance. And, you know, when you've got the only Democrat in the state, practically, sounding like a Republican, the things have gone kind of out of whack. The legislature is supermajority Republican, and the way things are lining up for this election is the Democrats are going to lose even more seats in the legislature. So there's going to be almost 85-90% Republican. And when you have a supermajority like that, that's just bad for everybody because you get the crazies on the extremes running things. You know, every state legislature's got their crazies. But when you have one party running a state like this, the crazies are running the committees and running things. And that's just not healthy.
Two questions. Can you see the Democrats disappearing in the near future here in the state of Utah? And the second one is, can you see a third party coming into the state of Utah, neither a Democrat nor Republican?
Well, you know, I keep thinking that the pendulum has swung so far this way that eventually it's got to swing back that way. It's kind of like the legislature gets together, and I think, you know, they can't be as bad as I remember them from last year, and they always exceed expectations. You know, somehow they're always worse. The Democrats, actually, this election cycle, they've put up some fairly good candidates. You know, Cook, who's a Brigadier General and LDS and, you know, fairly moderate guy, is a very attractive candidate, you know, as are a lot of other people. Ben McAdams, you know, very moderate. But with Romney being such a poll in the state, so many people are going to go out just to vote for Romney that it's going to kind of overwhelm, I think, the Democrats. So the Democrats are going to lose more seats in the House and more seats in the state Senate. And they may very well lose everything else in this. And that's got to be incredibly demoralizing. As far as disappearing, I don't think so. Because on the ground level, you see that the Democrats have a little more enthusiasm. And things are happening on the ground floor that I think are going to help them in the long run. For example, there are now groups of Mormon Democrats who formed up, and actually it was the Mormon Democrats who were the biggest caucus in the Democratic Convention this last year. And that's kind of a new thing, and we'll see how that spins out. As far as the third party, I've been kind of curious why a third party hasn't had more appeal these days when obviously the Democrats and the Republicans have got so many things wrong with them. You know, why can't somebody in the middle come through and appeal to people? And I've grown up, you know, seeing a lot of presidential elections where there have been third parties. And it used to be that people were elected president who didn't get over 50% of the vote. You know, Clinton ran against a third party candidate who took 5, 6, 7% of the vote, just enough to make sure that, you know, he didn't get over 50%. That's what used to happen. And I don't understand why it isn't happening now. You know, and there's such dissatisfaction with both parties. Maybe you've got some ideas, but I, to me, I'm clueless. I don't know.
Any other questions?
Hi, my name's Chelsea. I'm a senior here at the U. You mentioned that your political philosophy changed, kind of flopped from President Bush's administration.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been writing for 35 years.
Yeah.
So did your, I guess, how was that transition? And was, when you had more conservative cartoons, how did that fit in with the Salt Lake Tribune?
Oh, okay.
Or did you have more conservative
cartoons? Well, yeah, I did. You know, my early cartoons, you know, were fairly anti-feminist. You know, I'd fit right in with some of the Republicans these days. And it's not that, like, all of a sudden I flipped from being one to the other, but it was a gradual education. When I started at the Tribune, you know, I thought, government's evil, they can't do anything right. But I sat on the editorial board, and you have people come in and they have 35 minutes to pitch you on what they want. And so I was sitting in the editorial board meetings and, you know, I had fairly strong opinions about a lot of stuff. But if you actually listen to people, lobbyists, you know, there's a place for lobbying. If you actually give them time to kind of make their pitch and make their argument, you understand that nothing is black and white. You know, there's a lot of gray areas. And so that was part of my education, was realizing that I didn't have the answers. You know, and that if you listen to the other side and you actually gave them time to lay out their argument, you might go, oh, well, he has a point here. And then you kind of dig deeper and figure out what you really think about that. So that was an education to me. And, you know, then you realize, well, there are certain arms of government that do important functions. And like I say, it was kind of a gradual thing. But what radicalized me was George Bush. So up until that point, in the 1990s, we had Clinton, we had George H.W. Bush, and things were kind of floating along fairly well because you had people who were statesmen who could work with government and thought the government could work and thought the government should work. And it didn't matter who was in office. You know, you could get a good moderate Republican and he wouldn't be that much different from Clinton. But I really do think that George W. Bush was radical. And his approach to things changed things dramatically. And it divided us. 2001, September 11th, I think was a national trauma that we're still suffering from. You know. And things could have been handled differently, but they weren't. And here we are.
Oh, I had one if I could ask one more. What role do you see political cartoons taking in the future as newspapers, at least printed newspapers, become less common, I should say?
So when I started, there were 350, almost 400 cartoonists in the country. You know, now there are 45 newspapers that have cartoonists. Papers can't afford to keep a cartoonist. It's kind of, that's a luxury. But one of the ironies is that more people see my cartoons now than have ever before. I'm syndicated in over 150, almost 200 newspapers worldwide. I did a cartoon just about a week and a half ago about Malala Yousafzai, I think her name was, the girl who was shot in Pakistan by the Taliban. And so, you know, I did the cartoon and I put it out there, and it had over a million page views on Facebook. It just went worldwide. And it was kind of interesting to see that because all of a sudden my cartoon is showing up in French. So my cartoons get more exposure than ever before. But that doesn't mean that I make more money than ever before. You know, the internet is free, and so my stuff gets out there and it gets disseminated. And I think that personally, I have more of an impact than I used to because more people see it. But as far as cartoons in general, cartoons are popular. You know, people like cartoons, and it's very visual, and it's kind of custom made for the internet. We're just trying to figure out how we can survive without making a lot of money and still do this thing that we love. And people are trying different things. There's Mark Fiore, who won the Pulitzer 2 years ago, and he does an animated political cartoon. And I would definitely look his stuff up. Mark Fiore is just great. It's wonderful stuff. But he creates these interesting, fun, pointed cartoons, and they run for a minute or two. Another one that I would look at is Matt Boers, who does political cartoons, and he's actually just a little bit older than you guys. And he's approaching it differently than the rest of us. You know, each of my friends who grew up doing cartoons, we had a newspaper where they kind of took care of us. You know, they gave us a salary, they gave us health insurance, they gave us a place, you know, they gave us a desk. People like Matt Boers, he's doing it all online, and he's doing it all digitally, and he's getting into, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and all these things, and he's he's approaching it that way. And he's getting some interest and he's getting some jobs by doing it that way. And he had probably the best political cartoon of all last year. It was when Steve Jobs died. And you see Steve Jobs at the gates of heaven, and you know, there's St. Peter. And the reason he does this is because, you know, he knows every single cartoonist in the country is going to have Steve Jobs with St. Peter, and St. Peter's going to have an iPad, right? Just so he knows that. So he's got St. Peter with an iPad. And so he goes, "Steve Jobs, look what I got. I got an iPad." And Steve Jobs goes, you know, I'm a Buddhist. So, you know, why are you drawing me in this Christian kind of cartoon? And you know, I'm a Buddhist. I want to be reincarnated. And so St. Peter goes, "Are you sure?" He goes, "Yeah, I want to be reincarnated, you know." And so the last frame is you see Steve Jobs reincarnated as a worker in a Chinese factory. It's great stuff.
Pat, you spoke earlier about the Grandma Act of two legislative sessions ago. Could you speak to the sex ed controversy of the 2012 Utah State Legislature? And to what extent did you get responses from the public or the legislature to your cartoons?
Okay, that was the legislature passed a law saying that you couldn't. Oh, you got to remind me on this. It was the
legislature.
You could only teach. That's right. You could only teach abstinence only in school, and this is an issue that has been around forever. Back when I first started doing cartoons, legislature got down to actually mandating what kind of words you could use when you were talking about sex ed. And it always seems to pop up, you know. And now, the latest thing is they passed this law that you could only teach abstinence only, you know, in spite of the fact that it doesn't work. You know, there have been tons of studies that show that just teaching abstinence only doesn't work. People make better decisions when they're better informed, when they have all the information. And so the legislature, and if I recall right, they did this in one of the last-minute things, and they, you know, they passed about half of their bills in the last hour of the legislature, and so they sneak stuff in there. So this is one of the things that they snuck in there, and I did cartoons, and it was, again, the newspaper, the news stations, everybody was pretty outraged about this. And if you're going to have to remind me, did Herbert veto it finally?
He signed it at 9:30 at night on Friday.
Oh, okay. Where he thought people wouldn't notice. Yeah. And that's where it is now. It's law.
Sorry, I misspoke. He vetoed it at 9:30 on a Friday night. Peter Crook had just come out as his rival and said that he, if he had been governor, would have vetoed it.
Okay, right. So that's where we are. Yeah, and clearly Herbert caved to pressure because it was pretty foolish what they were doing.
All right, that's the conclusion of our formal broadcast. So please join with me in thanking our guests for an excellent forum.